Welcome to the podcast, Alex.
Very much.
I don't think I need to do a big introduction about you because I think a lot of people already know you as Global CCO and London CCO of BBH. But I was reading that this morning on my way here that you whilst you were AMV as their CCO under your leadership, you won 10 Grand Prix and 3 Black Pencils, which I think is unheard of. So I genuinely am really, really excited to have you here talking to you. So thank you for joining us. Can I start by asking you a classic question? And who was the first person that made you feel like you had talent?
Well, just to answer the first thing about all the Grand Prix and the black pencils and stuff like that, it's kind of there on my LinkedIn bio suggesting that I won them. Of course, there were other teams who were actually responsible for the work, and my job was to create the conditions for them to do it and stuff like that. So it's always that slightly dubious thing as a leader where you claim all this kind of success, and I'd like to think I had a small part of it, but the real credit needs to go to the people who actually won those awards.
Yeah,
So
fair.
just to get that on the record.
Yeah, no, totally. We'll get into the nitty-gritty of that and how who they are as well shortly, but fair enough. Well, tell me then who made you first feel like you had talent?
I don't know. I don't think there's one specific person who I remember. There's not, there's the classic story of the teacher who first spotted it. I think my dad was always very supportive, often not explicitly in kind of saying, "You've got talent, son," but he just he was a director who worked mainly in TV but did some films. And I just had a house that was full of books and full of films on VHSs back in the day. So he, more than anything, he created an environment where I could soak up loads of stuff like that, and then we'd chat about those things and stuff like that. So I think he kind of unconsciously perhaps steered me into a certain path of a creative kind of life. And and I think if he thought that I had no talent, he maybe would have suggested I do something else.
Yeah,
So,
fair. So how did you end up in advertising in the first place? I remember you saying it's a bit of a an orthodox journey, but
yeah, I mean, I never had any desire to get into advertising. It wasn't a job that was on my wish list. And I'll also be honest, and this can be a problem, is I didn't really know much about advertising at all. It wasn't something that I'd really heard about at school. You obviously see all the adverts on the telly and posters, but I didn't know how they were done or who made them or what the process was. So I started off, I lived in Japan for a year teaching English, and then I came back and I managed to kind of get a job working on an arts program at Channel 4 as a researcher, which was good fun, but it involved, as the title suggests, lots of research, lots of getting on the phone, cold calling people and stuff like that. And I'm actually a relatively introverted, shy person. I mean, less so now because you learn tricks to overcome it. But in my early 20s, this job where I was on the phone all the time having to talk to people was kind of a bit of a nightmare. But I did it and did okay. But then the program wasn't recommissioned. And I was kind of in between stuff. And is essentially a bit of nepotism, really, if I'm honest. My mum had a friend who was an advertising headhunter. She was kind of at the tail end of her career. She's sadly died now. She was quite a kind of absolutely fabulous kind of figure. I mean, a real kind of thing of the 70s, and she'd place people in CDP and all those kind of agencies. And because I didn't have anything to do, my mum said, "Well, why don't you go and talk to this lady, Jean McFarlane, and see if you're interested." And I said, "I'm not really interested in advertising, but okay." And then I went there and she spoke about it a bit. And I thought, well, it sounds quite interesting because, as I said, I didn't understand the process. And she had on her desk a big pile of CVs from art directors who were looking for copywriters. And she pulled the first one off and said, "There's this guy, Adrian, he's looking for someone. Why don't I arrange for you to have a beer in the pub?" And so we did. And then worked together for 25 years. So,
Jeez, that was literally the story. It sounds like kind of Bernie and Elton.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Wow. So where did you go from there then? And did she also explain that's how advertising works? You are in a team,
yeah,
and that you just stay together and take on the world.
Yeah, and to be fair to Adrian, he'd been to an advertising postgrad course, right, at college, and I hadn't at all. So he had a kind of book, and he kind of took a real chance on me because all I'd done was a bit of journalistic writing and some short stories and stuff like that. So I think he was slightly surprised when we met in the pub because he was expecting me to have been to college as well. But we kind of sat in my dad's kitchen for about 3 months, put a book together, and then got some placements at a few places and ended up at Saatchi's, where we stayed for, I think, 18 months on placement on £35 a week. It was like in the recession and stuff like that, so there was just no jobs.
Oof.
And then eventually did some work and got our first job there.
Wow. And how long were you there before moving on to BBH?
About 3 years.
3 years.
Yeah. And then we were lucky enough to get some work quite quickly. So right, kind of made a bit of a name. And then we actually got poached twice. BBH came and we said no. I mean, we were happy at Saatchi's, but it's a bit like saying no to Real Madrid.
Yeah.
It's a bit like, oh, Christ, have we done the right thing?
Was it literally John calling you to be like, come and join us?
It wasn't John. It was the kind of CDs under him at that stage. But then they called again. We did something else, and they called again a year later, and then we went.
Just on that front, when you were learning from not really having any classical advertising, not being taught the classical way of advertising, how did you must have learned pretty quickly the ropes. And did Adrian teach you, or did you have a mentor when you were at Saatchi's? Like, who pushed you to, you know, that's a good idea, that's a bad idea? Like, what was the first few lessons?
Well, I think certainly Adrian, having a formal experience of, you know, what advertising was, although, you know, it was very raw, just a year in college. I think the thing that was useful that I brought was that I had a completely fresh perspective and absolutely no baggage.
Yeah.
And the ads I knew were just ones I remembered on TV. I hadn't been leafing through DNA, D-annuals and stuff. I didn't have that kind of encyclopedic knowledge. And I think that what that meant was we came up with stuff that was unusual.
Mm.
And unusual in the sense that it was either really interesting or really, really shit. So there was very little in the middle. And when you're a young team, I think that makes you quite interesting.
Yeah.
So there's there was an element of that kind of chance occurring. And then we worked really hard as well and then learned quickly.
Yeah. Stuff like that. Wow. So talk to me about that first time at BBH. Going, there were some greats in that.
Yeah. And
call that BBH 1.0.
Yeah. I mean, it was extraordinary arriving, and not that we were hired to replace them, but the office we went into was Gorsam Worthington's office.
Right.
Kind of famous team around all the Levi's work and Boddington's. And when we were shown round BBH before we started, we went into their office. I'm not kidding you, there were like pyramids of DNAD pencils, really? And can awards. And blimey. I mean, they're one of the most, I think the Levi's ad that they did was the most awarded ad ever.
Is it?
And they said, this will be your office. And Adrian and I at that stage had one DNAD pencil. And it was like, Jesus Christ.
It's like no pressure / it's kind of intimidating.
Yeah. And I think, and this is a interesting lesson for other people going into places. I think the truth is that for the first 2 years at BBH, we really, really struggled.
Mm.
Saatchi's was a great agency, but the step up to BBH was quite big. And it was a far more process-driven, rigorous kind of agency. Saatchi's was quite free flow, a little bit anarchic.
Yeah.
You could get in kind of when you wanted, but you know, Hegarty ran a really tight ship, and he had a thing, you know, processes that liberate creativity. So it was, everything was quite very well structured, and moving from a culture that was very anarchic to one that was very rigorous was quite difficult. And also our rawness had kind of got us through at Saatchi's, and then BBH was a more professional, considered thing, and we got found out quite a lot.
Mm.
And I think it's a thing for the lesson just for CCOs now. It's like, I'm not sure in today's climate that I would have, or Adrian and I would have survived.
Really?
I think we may well have been made redundant or kicked out. but they kind of gave us that time. I think they saw some promise in the things. And then after about 2 years or so, we really started to hit our straps and things happened. So, you know, maybe things were more forgiving then. They could see the potential. But I do worry now sometimes that we give up on people very, very quickly.
Really?
Yeah, sometimes.
Okay.
It's kind of, I think the economic realities make it harder. Mm. I mean, there was more money swilling around. We were essentially a junior team at BBH. They probably thought, well, they're not costing us that much. Let's wait and see what happens.
Yeah.
Whereas I think sometimes now things are a bit more brutal.
Yeah. Wow. So did you have any almost like mentors or cheerleaders when you were in BBH then to help you make that first set of work and then how you get to that next level?
I didn't know. We had more mentors at Saatchi's, actually.
Ah.
So it's worth... We had... there's Bill Gallagher, who's a very famous, brilliant art director. Yeah. He's at DDB and Saatchi, and Richard Myers.
Mm-hmm.
Ed Robinson and Dave Hilliard. We were kind of in their group. They were brilliant to us. But at BBH, there was less mentorship. It was just you were just expected to be good. But there were lots of people who came in and gave tips and stuff like that. And Hegarty was still doing the day-to-day creative direction there. And he's a very good creative director, so he would give you very good feedback.
Yeah.
So you just had to kind of learn quickly.
Yeah.
And then you could make a mistake once, but you couldn't remake it twice.
No.
So it's that kind of pressure environment makes you good quickly and makes you grow up and makes you responsible.
Well, I want a part of this interview is I'd love to talk about the changes in environment to then to what it would be like now, because I think there is a slight change now.
Yeah.
But just before we go on to all of that, how did AMV come around? Because that's a fascinating decade for you, where you that's from pure creative to leader in running an agency. So I think I remember that being announced that you joined as you were creative partners, right? You went to AMV.
That's right.
So
yeah.
Was it Mr. Abbott that kind of gave you the call up at the time?
No, we never got to work with David Abbott. Yeah. He had retired by then. And Peter Suter had taken over and then he left and then Paul Brazier was running. And he hired us in as creative partners. And we'd actually had a year in between BBH. We worked at a digital agency called Glue.
Yeah, Glue Isobar.
That was good at the time. And although that experience was quite enjoyable and the people there were very nice, from a work perspective, it didn't really work out.
Because weren't they more digital?
Yeah, and they were trying to go through the line and stuff like that, so they brought us in and it worked to a degree, but I don't think they were quite set up for it, and that whole kind of gold rush of the digital kind of agency thing was slightly declining, and people realizing you just needed a more general, holistic experience around all kind of touch points. So we hadn't really made any work for a year, and the tail end of our experience at BBH was some things hadn't gone brilliantly there, which is also interesting. And so we were so hungry when we got to AMV to do work, and luckily we just went on this run where we just did ad after ad after ad. I think there's a point in your career where you kind of hit the wave, and you kind of know what you're doing, and it's an amazing feeling because you kind of think you can crack any brief and you get that kind of confidence and momentum. So we were in that stage. And I think we just got our head down and did the work and, you know, hopefully tried to be as nice as we could. And then after about 18 months, we were suddenly called for breakfast by the CEO who kind of said he was thinking of making us ECD. So it was...
Wow.
It was a real shock.
Really?
Yeah.
I want to talk about the wave part.
Because
how long were you created before you hit that moment where you were just, and you felt invincible, like any brief we're gonna nail, we can stand up in front of a client as well. And How long did it take to get to that point?
Well, honestly, about 20 years. I mean, there were moments at BBH in our career where I think we went on a bit of a run and we did some work, but to get to that feeling where, as I said, you kind of feel, as you say, invincible, it took that thing where you, I don't know, something like clicks in your brain where you just kind of get the structure of things, you get an idea, you understand the importance of execution, and you really understand the importance of surrounding yourself with the very best people and being very explicit in demanding that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was... can take. I mean, I think maybe it happens sooner for some people, but for us, it took quite a long time.
Wow. It just feels like you were so and always focused on the work. And also what you mentioned about bringing the right people around you. It takes some level of emotional intelligence to know who to do that.
Yeah, you kind of know. We worked with a great producer on all those things and stuff like that. You kind of find the best strategists to work with. You get relationships with the best account people who can sell your work. So there's always a bit of luck and serendipity involved in those things as well.
Yeah.
You need a great client to buy the work. But I don't know, all those things kind of fell into place. And I think in 1 year we did, it was like £4 or 5 million ads just back to back. We would just do one, do another, do one, do another.
Yeah, and they were good. They were good, big.
Yeah, they were like Guinness ads and National Lottery and Eurostar and Snickers, and it was, I mean, AMV had an amazing roster of clients as well. That helped.
Yeah. Wow. So let's go back to the when you got promoted to ECD, and that was a bit of a shock, and you were like, oh, wow, okay, what does that mean? Talk me, what was the first year of being promoted to ECD, or first couple of years like? Did anything change?
Yeah, very much so, because it wasn't particularly a job that certainly I was looking for.
Right.
We kind of recognised at AMV that we were doing well. We were in a seniorish position as creative partner, where you're kind of seeding and running a few accounts. And you kind of think, I don't know, maybe in a few years we might be deputies or something. Like that was our kind of mindset. And then this thing happened. It's like, Christ. And you know, I think we were only the fourth ECDs in AMV's history as well.
Wow.
And it was then by far the biggest agency in the UK by like 100 million in billings. So it was a huge responsibility. Jeez. And an amazing department. And as confident as we were at that stage, that having the confidence in our own ability to do work, and then, Christ, we got to lead all these teams. I mean, there were absolute legends there. And, you know, still, you know, like Tim Riley, who's still there, was there. It's like one of the creatives who I think is one of the very best I've worked with. I'm going to be his ECD. It's kind of ridiculous. So there was a little bit of imposter syndrome for 18 months or so, really? I'd say. And then also just getting into a different rhythm where, essentially as a creative, you have a sole responsibility to crack the work and do it as best as you can. And then you move to an ECD and your responsibility is to create the conditions for others to do that, to allow them to express their creativity and to make it better and not your own. And that transition is hard because you have to park your selfishness, park your ego a bit, allow others to take the limelight and the credit. And you know, I think we did that pretty well, but inside at the beginning, certainly it was like, oh, this is tough.
Yeah, really. Yeah.
And then you start to see the personal satisfaction in that over time. And then you think, oh, no, it's great.
Yeah.
Empowering people, letting them do stuff and things like that.
Because there is that moment where that letting go moment in management, isn't there, where you have to let stuff go. But what is it like? And how long did it take for you to become less off the tools, as it say, like less coming up with the ideas? Was that also 18 months, if that makes sense?
No, I think maybe 18 months to 2 years before you get some of that. For me, anyway, it might have been different for Adrian, to get that stuff out of your system where you feel, as much as you dampen it down, kind of slightly resentful that you're not the one who's doing it and getting the glory and the joy of cracking the creative problem yourself, which is the reason why people get into the job, I think. But you have to, I hope as much as possible I kept that inside.
Yeah. But...
And then you do reach a point where you feel a lot better about it. But we also tried to do a thing as well, which I think helped, which was a good, which worked out very well for us, is that each year we would try to do one piece of work.
Mm.
So you still keep that skill set going. And the other reason we did it was, and I think this really helped, is it reminds you of how hard it is.
Yeah.
And stuff like that. And the one of the things I saw with some creative directors when they got in for it for too long is that they seem to forget that because they hadn't done it, that it's really hard when you're confronted with a blank piece of paper, essentially, and then you have to fill it and come up with an answer. And it's tough.
Yeah.
And just reminding yourself of how tough it is a good trick, I would say, for any ECD or CCO to kind of do
that's
for as long as possible.
That's great advice. So when you took that step up, I want to know, because you were saying at the beginning of your career you had Saatchi's, which is quite free-flowing, quite, almost, I was going to say nomadic, where you can like rock up at any time compared to BBH. Did you take a mix of the two in kind of leadership styles and kind of creative cultures and try to build that at AMV, or was AMV more like a BBH?
I didn't take much of the anarchic, free-flowing Saatchi's thing to AMV, but I think certainly we tried to blend a bit of the BBH culture with AMV. AMV's culture was far more gentle than BBH's. It's kind of built up. Peter Mead had a lovely saying, when in doubt, be nice. They had a history, I think, right up until the early 2000s, they'd never made anyone redundant.
Wow.
So there was a real culture of kindness there. I'm not suggesting there wasn't at BBH, but it wasn't to the same. It was a little bit more, well, quite a lot more competitive, rigorous, intense.
School of Hard Knocks vibes.
Slightly, yeah. And that was a big part of its excellence. So as lovely as AMV was, and in many ways it probably suited my character more as well, but there were elements of that culture where there were a bit of a warm bath. And so just introducing some of that rigour from BBH into that culture to get a little bit more intensity,
yeah,
and rigour and, you know, demand for the very best, I think worked pretty well.
Wow. So I've got to ask then, how do you make sure that the creative culture is still thriving then? Be quite a big question, I appreciate.
I don't know, it's a kind of instinctual thing. So I'm
yeah.
talking about these things here as if there was some master plan that we then enacted. I think a lot of it was just feeling the atmosphere and the thing and thinking, this and it's nice and everyone gets on really well and there's a lovely kind of spirit, but it does need a bit an injection of energy and a bit more discipline and a bit more really, I think, recognizing what the very best work is and showing people where the bar is.
Mm.
So and that happened gradually over time, and also hiring in new people,
yeah,
is also really important because you create an internal competition. And the very best creatives look at someone new who's coming in doing well and kind of go, "Ooh, I better start doing that." So you create the kind of environment that you want by hiring people in who live it
and push it,
and then the very best rise to that and match it. And you know, there were some great creatives at AMV.
Do you want to mention any of them?
I mean, there are actually too many to mention, and that was the thing. It's like it was the depth of talent there that came through. But I mean, perhaps, I mean, I've mentioned Tim Riley. I worked with Nick and Nadia and Toby and Jim, perhaps those ones in particular, because they then helped form the kind of leadership group later on, but they also did some exceptional work. And I mean, they are really generational talents.
Yeah, that's amazing. Because... They were black pencil winning, right, those guys.
Yeah, and responsible for some of the Guinness work and Essity work. And of course, that's a big team, but they were right there at the epicentre of it.
That's amazing. So if you don't mind, can we focus on talent for a minute and what you look for in creative talent? Let's just say, because I don't want to forget about your move back to BBH as global CCO, because that's slightly different to AMV being, is it London and European? You may have touched kind of the BBDO network.
Yeah, I did a little bit of European stuff, but it's essentially London.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Talk to me about talent then and building a team. What do you look for in creatives? So if they were kind of 5 to 10 years into their career, what do they need to have done? What attitude do they need to have?
I don't know. There's a really wonderful book by Murakami, which is actually about running.
Yes. Yeah, I know of it. Yeah. I know of this book.
I can't remember the title. It's from a kind of Raymond Carver thing, which he...
Is it something marathons in it?
Everything We Want to Talk About Running or something like that. But it's essentially, he talks about running and writing as a kind of thing, and how the discipline of running has led to him being able to be a great writer. But there's a thing he goes on in there just about... He talks about talent, and this is... You know, there is this kind of narrative that comes out, and it's a beautiful thing. It's like, you know, you can do anything, darling. All you have to do is kind of want it, and then it will happen. And as lovely as that is, it's not true. Talent is, you either have it or you don't, I think, as a core thing. I think you can have a thing and then work on the craft and get better. But the truly great creatives just have some kind of thing, some kind of pathology has happened in their life or whatever it is, circumstances that give them that kind of X factor. And it's trying to spot that as much as you can. And then you look for in the work and it's as good a guide as any. It's just seeing bits of work, you think, God, how did they do that? I couldn't do that. Because you see lots of things, think, yeah, that's good, but I could do that.
Really?
It's nicely done, but I've done that kind of idea. And then you see things every now and again from teams and you go, ooh, that's just some weird left field thought that they've had to come up with. And I think those are the kind of indicators that are really good signals to look out for. And if you build a department with enough of those characters, they can create the excellence for everyone who will have talent, but not that super talent to kind of rise to. And this is a truth as well around great creative departments. So AMV was a wonderful creative department, filled with great talent. But I think if you look at a lot of places, it's actually two or three teams that actually make the difference and rise up and do the kind of work and stuff like that. And even if you look back at AMV back in the day, you know, it was like Tom and Walt. You had Flinton and McLeod at DDB. There are, if you have those kind of things, they can make it. They can make the difference.
Yeah, wow. So, but on the other side of that, like you, when it comes to particularly creative talent, do you think all good creatives can be good creative leaders?
No, and I think some of the very best creative talent often don't make the best leaders. So I think they're very different jobs. I mean, it's a lazy analogy, but a pertinent one. It's kind of like the very best footballers often don't make the best managers. And I think it might be a thing that when you're that good, and there's an element of that, not that it comes easy, but you have a different way of thinking, maybe you get frustrated with people who aren't quite as good.
Do you think it's because they're like artists?
Yeah, I think it's just, and it's a very, it's almost a kind of selfish individual pursuit often, and it's quite hard to then, I don't know, have the patience, the understanding of people who aren't quite as good to want to kind of motivate. They're often very impatient and stuff like that. So, for example, I think I'd be in a much, although I had a decent creative career, I think I'd be in a better and more successful leader than I have a practitioner.
Yeah.
And maybe that's because, you know, I get a real buzz out of seeing people who are really brilliant and putting them in a place and seeing what they could do and stuff like that, because you kind of recognize that they're better than I was and stuff like that. And that's quite exciting to be around and to witness.
So, yeah, I mean, I love that. I think that's really fair as well. But it still fascinates me how you can create that, the right environment for them to prosper. Is there any level of like protection that a creative department needs that the department might not ever see from the powers above? That
yeah, I think mentioned? a lot of the job is often you're kind of acting as a kind of blocker or a bouncer,
right?
Protecting people's time, making sure that they don't have too much on, but at the same time, not too little, because then you can just focus on one thing. And I think a lot of those things people don't see. Making sure that you put people on the right briefs, the whole casting thing is a thing that takes time to develop, to get an instinct for, well, that team on this problem. And often it's not the obvious choice. Sometimes something that appears a really knotty, not terribly sexy kind of brief, if you put the right team on, they can turn that into something else. And it's like, sometimes the insurance brief can be the best brief in the department, but you need the right team on there who can find the way into something like that.
That's interesting. I also have a question about presence for leaders as well. How do you stay present with your entire, I mean, I don't know the exact size of the creative team at BBH, but I imagine it's fairly large. How do you make sure that you're not necessarily accessible every single minute of the day, but like, how do you make sure that you're there for them? Like, because the reason I ask that is I've spoken to people before who have fantastic CCOs and ECDs, but there's a lack of connection somewhere. Mm. How do you make sure that there is still that connection with you and your team?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. It's difficult. And the obvious thing is you just have to get out and walk around and be interested and praise at the right time and cajole at others. I think one of the advantages I had at AMV was that because we started as kind of creative partners, it meant that we were closer to the creative department. I mean, not that we'd risen with them as a junior, but there was a thing where you'd spent more time in the pub, not as their boss, but as a kind of mate and rival in a good way, as a lot of time. And so then when we transcended into a leadership position, and there does become a bit more distance, but it was quite natural, so you could still talk to people about the work. There was, and I think we tried to, although we were in that position, we also tried to dampen the whole thing of hierarchy and stuff to make it less, you know, that we're the big cheeses and stuff like that.
You weren't in a glass box, were you?
No glass boxes. So I think that makes it easier, and it's an interesting thing being dropped into BBH as a thing. And I'm in a slightly different role, and, you know, it's got Helen and Felipe there as ECDs and deputy are doing an amazing job. And it has made me think about how difficult it must be for, and so I'm at a certain stage of my career, as I said, and this is a slightly different job, but if you were just dropped in as an ECD into a culture of that thing, and then you have to build, it's really hard. I think it's, and actually a lot of the really successful thing is that promoting internally makes it a lot easier.
When do you know when the right time to promote a CD to an ECD is? Well, have you had that pleasure of doing that before?
And I think the simple question is you don't kind of decide. What happens is that the kind of creative department and agency decide. There's just this kind of feeling that this person is now ready and has the followership to kind of do it. I mean, creative departments and agencies, I mean, creative departments especially, are quite weird organisms have this thing kind of going. And when someone is successful, they just kind of gravitate towards that person, and they often take on the mantleship of leadership before they've even had it, which is an interesting thing.
Makes your job a little bit easier.
Yeah, and I think that's, I do think the best leaders are ones where the job finds them, not the other way around. That's the best and often most successful way. And that's where I think you see great moments in an agency's kind of history. And I think that's the lucky thing that happened at AMV is the job kind of found us. We kind of built up some followership. And then there's just this, you have a period, and then that's taken on by someone else. And, you know, when I went back to BBH, I think I could see, I mean, I think I could have stayed there for a bit longer and we were tight and close, but it was time for Nick and Nadia to actually rise through, and they were ready, and the kind of creative department were ready for them as well. So the timing was good.
Wow. I want to go back to a talent for a second, because I feel like a lot of people are going to want to hear your thoughts on this. But like, if you can spot like a super talented team, but they're not quite ready for your department, like, what advice would you give them? Is that, it might be really hard to answer because you don't know the specific individuals, but is there like a consistency that you're seeing with, like I say, senior teams at the moment looking for jobs? And is there any advice that you would give to them to just focus on a certain thing before worrying about getting promoted to CD or ECD?
Yeah, I think there is a lot of energy wasted by senior teams in striving for titles and status that perhaps they're not ready for.
Right.
And even if they got them, they might not actually enjoy. Now, obviously, that's a generalized statement. It might not be true for everyone, but I still think there's a thing that if you have an absolutely stellar body of work, then the job and the opportunities will find you. And it's just to counsel a bit of patience. And I know that's difficult and people want everything. And I'm aware that there's the salary kick when you get a title. And I don't always agree with that. I think it would be good if, you know, you didn't have to get a pay rise just become a CD or an ECD. But for the most part, the system is built like that. But, you know, as I said, it took, I think one of the benefits I've had is I've had a long, slow, steady career. I didn't become an ECD till I was 46. I'm now 57. Wow. You kind of, I don't know, there's a thing, I think it's difficult if you are a superstar and you're an ECD at 32. Firstly, where do you go next? Maybe set up your own company. There's a thing there. But also the energy involved in doing that is a lot to take on. It is you carry a lot of weight as an ECD on your shoulders, and it never kind of goes. And just being a brilliant creative is a bit more freeing and liberating, and to be honest, more fun.
Yeah.
So do the bit that's fun for as long as you can, and then I think you'll have the experience and, I don't know, and be ready for a different stage of your career to do it. So I see people walk away from the work. They've done 1 or 2 hours. Right, now I'm ready to be a CD, and then a couple of years I'll be an ECD. And I think when you'll get there, it'll be really hard because you just won't have that depth of knowledge and experience. And just having seen, one of the things now, and it is that benefit of age and experience, is you see a lot of problems that you've experienced or encountered before. They're not the same, but they kind of are. And so you become less worried about them, and you think, if we stick to the process, we'll get through this, it'll be fine. Whereas at the beginning, when you haven't had those, they're kind of really terrifying.
I mean, experience has never mattered more, I think, particularly in this environment and economy.
I'm not sure it's valued as much as it is, and this isn't a rant about ageism, although that is there as well. But
why do you think that is?
I think economics.
Really?
Mainly. I think they're expensive, but I don't think the value of that salary is often seen enough. And I think a really great experienced team can kind of do the job of three or four teams often, because they're quicker, they're better, they get it first time. And I don't think that's taken into consideration enough. And listen, I'm all for that energy and freshness of youth and stuff like that is kind of exhilarating, and advertising trades on the next big thing the whole time and the new platform, the new technique. But it is still an industry based on brilliant, solid ideas that build a brand from the foundation. And people who've been doing it for 20 years are more likely to come to that answer than people who've been doing it for five.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I want to just talk about your work, because Jesus, you've made so many wonderful ads, so many brilliant campaigns over the years. Have you got a top three campaigns or ads or work that you've done which you're super proud of?
I think it's easier to talk about work that I haven't done, in a way.
Okay.
Which might be. And well, again, what, I was thinking a little bit about this, and I think there is a thing that things I love are, you know, an absolutely brilliant strategy,
right,
and then the execution on top. I mean, keep it simple. So, you know, an obvious one is the Guinness work. Good things come to those who wait. I mean, I Swim Black. It's one of my very favourite, probably my favourite of the three, the one that set it up. But there's another measure that I think is useful. So another campaign that I absolutely love is all the Honda work, and especially Cog and Hate It and things like that. And one of the reasons, as well as to that kind of thing, seeing a bit of work going, I never would have come up with that.
Yeah.
But also, and this is a really interesting thing to think about a lot of the time, because I don't think enough creatives do, is that that work for Honda actually worked on me. I remember I was in the process of getting a car, and, you know, we were looking at the standard Audi, BMW, VW, and we put a Honda on the list of cars to kind of consider. And I think that was the brief that they were doing. It was to have a car that people thought was a bit shitty, without character, and to actually put it out there and say, no, this is really brilliantly engineered.
Wow.
And then they created a kind of personality for them. So actually having a piece of work that to someone, you know, because you know how it works and you know the tricks, it's often quite hard for things to really work on you.
Yeah.
So as much as I love the Guinness work, for example, it doesn't particularly make me want to go out and buy a pint of Guinness. I just like Guinness.
Yeah.
Maybe it reinforces it. But that actually shifted me into considering a Honda as a car that I might buy. And then, I mean,
Which one was it? Was it Cog, Hans, Illusion?
I think just that whole body of work around there, they just kind of suddenly presented themselves in my mind as a kind of brilliantly made premium brand that, oh, actually might be quite a different, interesting choice if I drove a Honda. Oh. Might make me more interesting as a person.
And you could talk to your advertising friends about it.
Yeah. And then, as other bits of work, I always think if you look at the best expression of a particular thing, so like the best manifesto ad ever written, so Apple, here's to the crazy ones.
Yeah.
Best kind of product demo, VW snowplow.
Mm.
Best challenger strategy, Avis, we're number two, we try harder. Those kind of iconic kind of pieces of work where, again, they're just almost flawless.
Yeah, wow. That's good to know. I hope people listening to this will have to go and look up those ads if they don't know them already. I do, but... okay, we're near the end. But I've got to ask, is there a biggest fail in Alex Greaves' career? Because it's been remarkably successful, but are there any big lessons? May we reword this? Best, worst thing that's happened?
Many, many, many. as you would expect. No. Anyone who says they haven't failed almost repeatedly is lying. I mean, classic ones on...
Even on a pitch? Like.
Yeah, I mean, a couple of pitch things and interesting things at both points in my career. So one of the very first pitches we did when we were made ECDs at AMV, I wasn't going to mention them, but it was for Virgin.
Right.
So it's quite a big deal. And we just made the classic mistake of trying to do everything ourselves. So to go in there, be the ones who solved it, you know, charge through on our big white horse and kind of save the day. And the thing that happens is you get so into it because you're doing the work that you absolutely lose any outside perspective of what the best answer should be. And then because we were leading it and then trying to do the work, also, we didn't have a CD because we were the CD, so you couldn't check, is this actually any good?
Yeah.
And then you also start to kind of piss off teams because you're leading too much from the front. And the net result of that was we didn't just lose it. It was a really bad pitch.
Mm.
Everything was last minute. The thing was a bit of a shambles. The team were disengaged and pissed off. And as a first kind of big project for us to do, wow, that was quite chastening. And we got quite severe feedback.
Really?
From the CEO. But, and the lesson there is, as I said, I think it's fine to make a mistake once, but so there's a very quick reset that we did, kind of going, right, we are never going to try and do the work again. We will sit above, we'll just judge it, we'll just do what we've been doing as CDs. And then I think a few months later we had the Currys pitch, which was a really big bit of business, and then we won that.
Yeah.
So there is also a thing, it's fine to fail.
Yeah.
You have to learn from the thing and then not do it again.
Yeah, totally.
And the thing that's frustrating as a CD when you see teams repeatedly making the same mistake, even when you're trying to give feedback.
Yeah.
And that can be a thing. But then there was another thing later on at AMV, right at the end of our time there, and I won't give the brand in this time, but the mistake I made then, because I was on my own by then, was actually, and there was, as I said, there's great creativity. I got a kind of Harlem Globetroppers of all the best talent in AMV around this kind of project, and then actually gave everyone slightly too much autonomy,
right,
and too much respect. And I looked back, and actually what it needed was for me to be more decisive in saying, this is all good, but this is the thing we should do. And so the net effect of that, it was slightly too scattergun. Mm. And even though the talent was there, I didn't marshal them in the right way to get the result. And that one was, it was still a good pitch, but it was slightly off. And there were some things that I knew that weren't quite right. And because, you know, really, I didn't want to have a tough conversation with someone who is really great to say, I'm not sure that's as good as it could be. It was that 5% off, and that 5% is everything when you're up against other brilliantly talented agencies. And
wow.
I think we came second.
Wow. That's really interesting as well. It's particularly the first story you told about it took you to get to ECD before you made that mistake to really run an entire pitch. I find that fascinating, genuinely. Okay. Well, I think we've smashed that. I don't think we need to do any longer. I mean, we can edit it as well, but is there anything else that you would like to us to chat about? I'm just trying to...
Not, I was just thinking of kind of other bits of...
Kind of...
Things to pass on as kind of bits of advice for...
Yeah, I think you've given some brilliant advice on talent.
Teams. I mean, but just a thing for talent, the thing that's really helped me, and again... Took many years for me to truly understand and get there as and certainly the beginning of our time at BBH for many years actually, I think we were incredibly caught up in the pursuit of a winning awards,
right,
and thinking about the outcome of what would happen, particular things, and there was a kind of light bulb moment for me when I kind of stopped worrying about that and just tried to get much more into enjoying the process and learning from the process. So kind of starting a job and not thinking, God, if we do this and this comes off and this idea happens, and that could mean we could get a can gold and more salary, more thing. And just kind of going, I'm going to go in here, we're going to do our best, we're going to try and learn as much as possible, and we're going to work with interesting people and be curious about them and try and bring them on. And at the end of that project, we'll see what we've learned and see if we're any better. And if that then goes on to win an award, then great. But if it doesn't, it doesn't really matter because we've learned all of this.
Mm.
And that might have been a self-protection mechanism rather than some amazing, wise kind of thing. But it worked very well because it kind of takes the pressure off.
Mm.
And I think from that point, we became a lot better.
Yeah. I think I read somewhere that the creatives that enjoy the process more are generally more successful rather than just getting caught up on just wanting to win awards. Mm. I can't remember who said that, but that makes a lot of sense. And I think that's really sound advice as well.
Yeah.
Nice way to end.
Yeah.